Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Balance Podcast. Today, I'm talking to Zoe Aston. Zoe is the author of Your Mental Health Workout, a 5-week program to a healthier, happier mind. She's a London-based therapist, a mental health consultant, a speaker, and as I said, she's an author, and she's got over a decade's experience of working with mental health. She's also the creator of a 5-week program online that will help you get your mental health in shape, and she works with leading names in the wellbeing industry. So, hi, Zoe. It's really great to talk to you. I can't wait to hear more about the mental health workout. I think it's such a good idea. And I think the use of the word workout appeals to me as someone who's into fitness. And I see you've got some amazing clients from your website. I saw people like Dr. Zoe Williams, Mr. Motivator, who work with you. And do you think that way of working, that your method and approach attracts the kind of person who is into fitness and health? And if so, why that?
Yeah, first of all, hi, and thank you for having me on the podcast. Yeah. Appreciate being here and having the opportunity to talk and the platform, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I think sort of coming away from what I used to do, which was work in very intense sort of rehabs and treatment centres with addictions and eating disorders and trauma and whatnot, moving into the sort of wellbeing industry was quite a relief for me, because they're mostly people who just want to get healthier rather than not be sick, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a totally different experience for me. But I think particularly for people like some of the names that you mentioned just then, who have been skeptical of therapy or stuff around mental health, or haven't quite been able to get their head around it in the past, the idea that you can work on your mental health just as you can work on your physical health is really attractive to them, because they can immediately understand it better. And it actually gives them a segue into looking at things like trauma and feelings and all the stuff that we sort of avoid, and can, if we're not careful, even use physical health, you know, exercise and food to get away from. It gives them a segue into that, and it allows a sort of much more holistic approach to their well-being. And as soon as people get a little taster of that, it like opens up this whole world of well-being, of health, that they hadn't even really sort of considered would be beneficial before. So I think, yeah, the way that I work does attract people who have maybe been skeptical about therapy in the past, or felt that mental health was stigmatized, or there was a taboo around it. So I'm really pleased to be welcomed into the wellbeing community in the way that I have.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that there's a sort of almost two ways of looking at it. A lot of people, having worked in wellbeing myself, I see a lot of people see wellbeing as a problem to solve, rather than wellbeing being what it is to live a better, yeah, healthier, fulfilling life. And if that means you do a little self-examination along the way, and it's a little, gets a dark at times, that's no bad thing. It's the same as lifting weights and hurting, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the type of metaphors that I draw on when I'm in the room with people and I'm doing groups, and sometimes even in one-to-ones, and someone's like, I don't want to do this, it's really painful. I'm like, you're just holding a squat.
Yeah.
Like, and it's going to hurt, and then you're going to stand up and you're going to give it a shake, and then tomorrow you're going to feel stronger. You know, yeah, that's, you know, drawing those comparisons is really helpful. And it also brings a bit of light into it, and people start, yeah, laughing because it's kind of a little bit funny, but it just allows us to have a little bit of kind of light and joy in the healing process, which can be very painful.
Yeah, yeah. And you're absolutely right. Everybody, you say everybody has mental health, and that, you know, it's like life is not just skipping through daisies, having a wonderful time. You know, we have to explore and examine. So your 5-week program and book, I mean, as I'm going to keep saying, probably, I love the workout metaphor. You know, there's a lot of books out there. How's your book different from, say, a self-help book that you might grab off the shelves?
Well, it is a self-help book, you know, and it's in that section in the bookshop. So, it is a self-help book. I think the thing that makes it different is that historically books like mine that have had sort of steps to follow in have been very CBT led or sort of therapy model based, and based in the sort of empirical evidence and, you know, all this stuff, which generally required people identifying that they had a problem before they reached for that book. So, for example, if you go for like a CBT book, like, you know, here's how to stop being anxious, 12 ways to stop being anxious, or CBT yourself to help manage your anxiety better, you have to identify as anxious in order to feel like you can read that book. Whereas right from the start, I wanted Your Mental Health Workout to be a book that everyone could pick up at any time, mm-hmm. and it would help them. And whether specifically as well, I wanted to target men. I said in my very first publishing meeting, I want a guy to be able to pick up this book and not feel embarrassed that he's reading a self-help book. No pink, no flowers. Like, I just want it to be really kind of neutral and equal to all the different groups of people who are out there. Yeah. Because for someone who's got a history in their family of mental health being like not talked about, to then be seen reading a book that says like CBT for anxiety on the front, it's really quite challenging, and probably they're not going to do it. So in my mind, the difference is that you do not have to have an identifiable, diagnosable problem or issue to read or even do Your Mental Health Workout. It's just like when you go to the gym, we go to the gym with our arms and our legs and our heads and our torso, and we work with what we've got to feel better, to, you know, change maybe what we've got a little bit, hone and tweak what we've got a little bit. But ultimately we go because we're already well and we want to feel healthier. And Your Mental Health Workout is exactly that, but for the mind.
Yeah, and it makes such sense. I mean, another sort of example of what you're doing in a different sphere is like in the alcohol world, where, you know, people like, there's 1 year no beer and club soda and people like that who are dealing with grey area drinkers. So they're not necessarily falling down alcoholics with pouring vodka on their cereal, but the kind of thing, I want to do better. Yeah. So, and, you know, the same thing. You don't want to be seen reading a book saying I'm an alcoholic or I'm
exactly
up, you know, on the train. And I do like the other thing about that made me think of that is that there's that challenge approach. And when you said about men, I think when you feel you're about to go on and do something and have a goal and it's a program and it's a challenge, and, you know, it's more engaging to a bigger group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got your own backstory, which you've shared in the book, and you've recovered. As we said, life is not black and white. So can you tell me more about your story and how it informs the work you do?
Yeah, sure. So, my entry into the mental health field came out of my own experience of my own mental health and my struggles and my difficulties. I think I struggled with my mental health, with my feelings from when I was very, very little. I don't know. I can't remember exactly all the details that I give in the book, but yeah, I do say this actually, but like, I was very shy. You know, people would have looked at me and said, oh, she's, you know, she's shy, she's socially anxious. Nowadays, I kind of understand it more as a this thing that we're naming highly sensitive. So like the highly sensitive personality type, it's, the research is still emerging, but there's more and more and more about it. And even my mum will now read a book or watch a film and she'd be like, this is what you were.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, but it was painful to be that sensitive a person in a not very sensitive world.
Yeah, yeah.
And still to this day, like, I have really, really big feelings and I cry. When I cry, like, you've never experienced, like, you've never seen someone cry the way that I cry. It's a sort of a bit of a joke in my family, but, you know, I do have very big feelings. I am very sensitive, and that I was born with.
Yeah.
But the world, the society, the social space that I was born into, a white middle class family, there wasn't really kind of accommodation for that. You know, we didn't know how to deal with it. So in order to deal with it, I developed these coping mechanisms around food, either not eating or binging and purging, and then self-harming came in. I was bullied quite badly, and I think that was what prompted those types of behaviors. But I do think all the way through my childhood, I can see a sort of sensitive depression, anxiety thing kind of kicking about. And then by the time I was, gosh, I would say 18, is when I was at dance college, like, I really was very poorly. I was very high functioning, however, which is what I think was confusing for a lot of people. And lots of people with eating disorders are very high functioning because we're just running on adrenaline the whole time. And then, by the time I was 20, I was in treatment for the eating disorder and the self-harm and all the other bits that go with that, the relationship stuff, the codependency, the trauma, and generally kind of learning to like myself and work with what was happening rather than rejecting myself as well as the world.
Yeah.
And after that, I was working as a dancer, and I still struggled for, you know, a number of years. But what I think happened after that was that I had really good foundations. And despite myself, the therapy had kind of worked.
Yeah.
Because I knew what I needed to do to look after myself. So when people say to me, you know, how long is it going to take to fix me? Or how many sessions do I need? I'm always like, this isn't going to fix you. Like, I hate being the therapist that says that, but I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to fix you. Like, I'm going to give you the foundations. I'm going to get you to a point where you can choose how you want to behave, how you want to look after yourself. And then it's over to you. Yeah. You know, then you, once you have the power to make the choice, that is over to you. So that's kind of how I ended up coming into therapy. I realized that the dance world, the dance industry just wasn't very complimentary to what I needed. I was sort of too sensitive for it. Yeah. And ironically, I believe if I could redo my dance career now, I'd be a much better dancer. I'd probably be far more successful because I've got a lot more confidence and self-esteem behind me. Whereas then I was just so insecure and vulnerable that it filtered through to everything to do with my life. So yeah, I often think I'm a better dancer now, not that I'm training now, but I'd be a better dancer now than I was way back when, because I'm much more comfortable with myself and my body. So I went off to study psychology, and I did a master's. I did a sort of foundation year, then I did a master's, and then I just felt like I'd landed where I was supposed to be, because everything just felt easier. I managed to get a scholarship for my master's. I landed a job on Harley Street almost immediately. I had a couple of other ones before that, and then I set up my private practice in 2015. And you know, people kept coming back, and for someone who's quite insecure, that's always a bit of a shock that people like what you're doing and they keep coming back for more. But and still to this day, I think the thing that surprised, someone asked me recently what surprises you most about the work that you do, and I say I still get a bit of a surprise when people come back or companies come back and they want more of what I've got to give. And you know, I think that's the thing that helps my confidence in the work, but also still surprises me.
A bit of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, a little bit. I think we all have that. I think also because I'm quite young for working in my field and doing the things that I'm doing. And sometimes I'm a bit like, do I actually know what I'm doing here? And then I get talking. I'm like, oh yeah, don't worry. Like, I know what I'm doing.
It's interesting. Because, you know, your sensitivity is also probably what makes you empathetic to people. You understand other people's struggles. You know it. And you learn on the job, didn't you? You learn all the tools that fix, well, not fix, that's the wrong word, that help people to
support.
And support.
Yeah.
So you learn.
And I think that's it. You know, being a therapist, I had no choice other than to keep working on myself. And maybe that's why, because sometimes we say therapists are wounded healers, or most of us are wounded healers. And I think that's true. Often the most hurt or the most wounded are the people that go into the caring industries, because we need that structure of care in order to continue to care for ourselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, remember that if anyone's in therapy.
Yeah, and you've got, yeah, exactly. And you've got a lot to offer. And I love what you said about when it suddenly wasn't, it was easy, you know, it wasn't hard anymore. So, because that's a real, for people who are struggling, they would never feel that, you know, nothing feels easy. You're always at dead ends. And it's that thing about you're on the flow, the river's flowing with you, or you're flowing with the river, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. What I would say is it did feel easy. I felt like, oh, this, all the opportunities are here for me now. The doors are opening. Yeah. That bit felt easy. The actual journey of becoming like a seasoned therapist is pretty hard work, but I wanted to do it. And it felt like work that I was capable of doing and succeeding at. Whereas in the dance industry, I just always felt like I'm never going to be that person. That's, you know, I'm never going to get there or get to the next step of the ladder in my career. Whereas I could see my career as a therapist.
And I bet you worked hard at the dance as well, didn't you? I bet you were a hard worker when you were doing that, and you just put it against the where you were meant to be.
Exactly. You know, I was in ballet at 8:15 or 8:30 every morning. You know, I'd be sitting outside. I was the first one there. You know, I've always been a hard worker, but it just wasn't. And I was good. I just wasn't great. And to be successful in the dance industry these days, you have to be great. You have to be pretty phenomenal, because I didn't believe in myself.
You're great at what you do now. So
exactly. I found my thing.
You did. And I've gone off piste a bit, but it's really interesting hearing you talk about it. So, we're talking about the flow and going in the right direction. I mean, we're interested at balance, about what makes people happy and, you know, what in general, but also you in particular, you know, what do you think? I know it's a big question, but anything spring to mind if I said, what makes you happy? What is happiness?
I believe that I have a sort of baseline of contentness that I have in my life now that I've kind of worked to get to. I made a decision quite a long time ago to not really have anything in my life that didn't bring me joy. Because, you know, for a long time, there was no joy. And I look around me sometimes and I think, well, where's the joy in this person's life? And I look at people inviting things that are hard and difficult. And sometimes we don't have an option. But where I do have an option, I will only keep people, places and things in my life that bring me happiness. It's a bit like an emotional Marie Kondo situation.
Yeah.
I knew who Marie Kondo was.
Yeah, exactly that. I remember trying to do that with my clothes and it didn't quite work, but I like the idea.
Yeah, no, I get sort of emotionally attached to my items. I was looking at something the other day and I was like, I've had this for years. Does it bring me joy? I was like, I don't know, but I've kept it so long, I'm going to keep it. But anyway, yeah, I made a decision a long time ago to only bring things into my life that make me happy. And what I found is that I'm quite happy with not that much. People often ask me about, you know, what's next? You're working so hard. What have you got on? People say, oh, you're so ambitious. And what's your goal? And I often feel happiest when I am just sort of content in the moment. And I'm very aware that I say this from a privileged position where I do have, you know, a comfortable lifestyle and a comfortable background. And not everyone has the options or the opportunities or the platforms that I've had to get to the place that I'm at. But anyway, I'm coming back to my happiness, but I just think it's important to say that, because when I say, you know, I'm content with a relaxed lifestyle, it's very privileged to be able to say that.
Well, isn't it? Because you've created that, and it wasn't always that way for you. Yeah. And you
it wasn't always that way.
You know, anybody, I mean, it's not an easy place to get to, but I think anybody can be happy in the moment.
Yeah, and I think that's true. Everyone can be happy in the moment, but also it's okay to not be happy in the moment.
Yeah.
But basically, my sort of, I'm very happy. The things that bring me happiness are, first of all, being able to wake up without an alarm, so not have to set an alarm, although I have a cat that acts as an alarm most mornings. I'm very happy working with my clients one-to-one. I love making the connections for people and exploring who different people are and getting to know different people. That goes in my kind of in my personal life as well as in my professional life. I really enjoy food these days. I really enjoy exercise these days. I really enjoy, one of the things that has made me happy, I've discovered this makes me happy, is long walks, which is a lockdown thing. Mm. You know, going for long walks. I live near Hampstead Heath, so long walks at Hampstead Heath or Primrose Hill or somewhere green and grassy. So really quite simple things, as well as things like going shopping. But I would say that I like the shopping, but I don't find that the happiness comes with getting the stuff home and then thinking, oh, do I really want this, or how do I have to take it back? But something like shopping is something that I do if I was actively trying to make myself feel better or feel happier after a difficult scenario. Anyway, I'm going off tangent now.
No, it's funny. Yeah. Shopping one is I once had said to my daughter when she came home at Christmas, oh, we'll go to Brighton, we'll go shopping. And I had this image of us arm in arm with bags shopping. We got there and it was awful. And we were both going, right, it's like this, and it's raining. And so shopping is nice, but sometimes it doesn't turn out that way.
I'm quite capable of shopping my way out of having had a difficult time or feeling not great about myself. Yeah. But I'm aware that it's the shopping, I think, for most people is like a fantasy of sort of starting afresh or turning yourself into a different person, getting a new outfit, I bought some skincare the other day, you know, stuff like that. It's about changing a little bit about what's happened. So
whereas walking is just, I think what you said about walking, and a lot of people have discovered that in lockdown, that going for a nice long walk is, you will be in the moment when you go for a walk. And that, as you said right at the beginning, is kind of where the happiness is, when you're just there and doing simple things.
Yeah.
So I mean, we could talk, I can tell already, we could talk on for ages on lots of different things, but I want to get into your book and some of the things you've said. So I'll just sort of say that you said that looking after our mind should be as accessible as eating right, sleeping well, and physically exercising. So what do you think the key things, I mean, it's probably those three, eating right, sleeping well, physically exercising, that you can do as an individual to really look after your mind? And, you know, what do you talk about in the book, potentially some of the tips you have in the book that we could take away?
I think fundamentally, it always comes down to what I call in the book, your core stability workout, which is your self-esteem.
Nice.
Everything in the book, you could look at everything in the book as a self-esteem and self-care program. Lots of the things in there, lots of people are doing anyway, but they don't necessarily do those activities with their well-being or their mental health in mind. So what I've done is sort of reworked or reframed some of the day-to-day activities that we do anyway to be mental health workouts, so that you can understand, how to do it, why to do it, what to expect, et cetera, et cetera. And each chapter is broken down like that. But fundamentally, I always come down to self-esteem and your relationship with yourself and how resilient, how strong your core is. And anyone who exercises will know that if your core is out of shape, everything else feels a little bit more difficult and you start to compensate and you get injuries. And in terms of mental health, your injuries or your compensation look like anxiety, depression, disorders, trauma reactions, feeling dysregulated, stress, burnouts, etc. So my big thing is, if we all worked on our self-esteem and we had that in really good shape, then we would see much less of these mental health issues, in inverted commas, and much less inequality and much less judgment. And because self-esteem isn't feeling better than other people, it's feeling equal too. So it takes the judgment out of the situation. Yeah. And I do believe it might be a little bit sort of magical thinking slightly, but there is, I say this a lot, there is a belief in me that if everyone authentically worked on their self-esteem and had that where they wanted it and needed it to be, we would have much fewer issues in the world, systemic issues, social issues.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So my main thing is always self-esteem. Come back to your self-esteem. And in the book, the core stability workout is a warm-up along with some boundaries and some vulnerability stuff. But throughout the book, I say if ever you fall off the wagon, you just come straight back to the self-esteem stuff. Yeah. That's where you get up from. And how you work on your self-esteem, the workout is...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Obviously in the book, but there's two steps which I expand on, but ultimately it's about doing esteemable things, doing actions and movements and activities in your day that give you the message that you care about yourself. And that means doing self-care stuff, basically, and looking after yourself and being a grown-up and getting the bills paid and feeding yourself right. The amount of people who come into therapy and they say, I want to work on my confidence. And I go, okay, fine. So we're going to work on self-esteem rather than confidence first. And then I look at how they're looking after themselves. They're not feeding themselves right. They struggle to go to bed on time. They're late for work or they're too early for work. And they end up anxious and burnt out and feeling like they're not good enough. And I'm like, all right, well, let's just adjust the self-care actions. And then automatically you feel like you like yourself because you're behaving like you like yourself. And the other part of that is the thoughts and the thinking and challenging that back chatter and those negative core beliefs that we all have and they all pipe up at some point.
Yeah.
Learning to be your own cheerleader and learning to affirm yourself, learning to, yes, set limits and behave moderately, but also do it in a really kind and compassionate way inside of yourself. So that's the internal work. And some people need to do the actions and the movements and the practical stuff first, and then the thinking follows. And some people need to do the thinking changes and then the practical stuff follows. You just got to sort of play with it until you find what you need. Because a bit like physical working out, you know, some things are different for different people.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you include physical exercise in the book as a part of the structure of doing the program?
Yeah, so I talk about physical exercise as it's important to do it 3 times a week. I sort of prescribe it 3 times a week. But because there's already so much information out there around the benefits of physical exercise and mental health, I don't talk too much. I talk a little bit about the sort of biology behind it and the biochemical reactions. Yeah. But I focus mainly on tips and ideas on how to make your physical workout more of a mental health workout, which is great for people who don't like working out. Because, you know, I like exercise. I used to be a dancer, love moving. You know, that's kind of how I express myself a lot of the time. But for some people, they just don't like exercise, and that's fine. But if they are interested in looking after their mental health, which they probably are, if they picked up my book, and they can reframe exercise as something that is good for their mind, then we get a different take on the matter. So I talk about it 3 times a week, and in there I also describe what kind of workouts work for different types of people, so you can sort of look through them and be like, okay, so maybe I'll try yoga, or I'll try some cardio, or I'll try this, or I'll try that, depending on what type of stress or complexities you're dealing with.
I think it sounds so good, because you know, a lot of the time it is just about being conscious, isn't it, about tuning in to yourself and knowing what you were saying about paying the bills or looking after your self-care extends beyond having, you know, having a hot bath and putting the candles on. It's about how you live your life day to day. And I think it goes as far as, like, you know, if I haven't watered my plants, I think, oh, that's self-care. You know, you're not looking, you're letting things die around you. It's the whole consciousness and being aware and being tuned in. And by having the structure that you've set out, that means people will do it. And it goes back to what you said at the beginning. It's not a problem. It's, you know, a solution orientated mindset, isn't it?
So yeah, absolutely.
Each decision you make is positive. And you said about there's a stigma about talking about taking care of your mental health. But have you seen, like, since COVID, there seems to be much more openness. I don't know whether I'm imagining that or whether there is, but there seems to be a bigger discussion about mental health in recent years. Have you seen improvements or would you like to see more improvements in the...
I've definitely seen improvements. Absolutely. And during COVID, I think we couldn't ignore the fact that people who had never had any kind of problems with their thoughts or their feelings or their behaviors were starting to feel things like anxiety or stress or burning out or having panic attacks. And it really kind of shocked them and the people around them that were working with them. So yes, I think there is an open conversation, but like you, Fiona, because I live in like the mental health bubble, I assume that it's being talked about everywhere in exactly the way that I talk about it with people like yourself. And then sometimes I sort of segue out and I end up in groups of people where I'm like, oh, they never talk about this stuff and they just want to pretend that everything's okay. And I forget that. So I think there is still, you know, the desire, particularly in England, to sort of pretend that everything's okay and kind of get on with it. And I've been known to upset people because I say, oh, you look tired or you look stressed or are you okay, and then they get very upset because they just want to pretend that nothing's wrong. And then I remember that not everyone is talking about mental health and emotional well-being the same way that I am. But yes, I think that ultimately there have been improvements, and lots of the corporate events that I do, managers and leaders and CEOs are asking for more and more help with how to work with their teams and include emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. The struggle I see at the moment is that businesses want to talk about mental health and they want to be seen to be looking after the mental health and the emotional well-being of their staff, but they don't want it to affect the productivity of the work.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, sometimes people get the message that, you know, please be open and vulnerable and tell us when you're not okay, but the work mustn't suffer. And I think that's quite difficult for people because they're like, but if I say I'm not okay, then I'm seen as, you know, I'm going to put in inverted commas, weak, because there's still the stigma attached to it. And then they worry about their promotion or their bonus. So there's still this big conflict around how much we share and the way that it might affect particularly our professional lives.
Yeah. And I think it's, and to be horribly, I think it's true. It would affect a lot of people's professional lives because a lot of the people who are leading probably have mental health problems themselves. They don't want to address them. And, you know, the more, as you said, if everyone looked at their self-esteem and looked, you know, the world would be a better place if everyone looked inward a little more. But at the moment, not everybody is. But there are changes outwardly, which will probably take another 20 years before people start to really do something with it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, workplaces are very much about, it may be being, there's probably an element of ticking boxes on well-being as a general thing. But, you know, you do need to build emotional resilience at work. Mm-hmm. And that would be something maybe the board might relate to, you know. Yeah, resilience, we need that because that's productivity. So how do you build emotional resilience? Are there things you do? Is it doing your program?
Yeah, great question. I actually did a workshop with some interns the other day on exactly that, building emotional resilience. And we focused on self-esteem to start off with, and then boundaries, how to, you know, use healthy boundaries in order to create healthy relationships and intimacy in the workplace, and how to make sure that you can handle other people's feelings, because not everyone has healthy boundaries. Sometimes people get angry with you. It's not actually about you, it's about them, you know, understanding all of that. And then we looked at what we call the window of tolerance. So using self-esteem, the self-esteem exercises and the boundary work to expand how we handle intense emotions, let's put it like that. So in a nutshell, we all have a particular window of tolerance. For example, mine was very small for a very long period of time. But by doing that work and strengthening those particular muscles, let's call them self-esteem, boundaries, naturally you're able to handle more and more of your own vulnerability and judge yourself less. And when things do go wrong and you have big feelings about it, you don't feel like you're going to burn out, or you don't plummet into shame and never want to go back to that place again. You deal with it because it's within your emotional, I call it your range of motion, your psychological range of motion. So yeah, when I go in, I talk to people about resilience. I focus on self-esteem and boundaries ultimately. Yeah. And that leads to a discussion about feelings and tolerating feelings and understanding and tolerating other people's feelings, which we are really bad at. We do not like other people having feelings.
Yeah, it's very true. I think, you know, when you think about your sensitivity as a child, for example, I mean, I was a sensitive child as well, so I completely understand that. And but you forget that your filter of the world is yours, and what you see, the person next to you doesn't see. And it's, you know, to really understand, and sometimes when you're in the midst of your own emotional troubles, you even see it even less. But I think it's probably, would you agree that it's really important to get that everybody sees the world differently?
Yeah.
Everybody's seen it through their filter. And so you can't really ever assume anything.
And I think that's why I think being a therapist is highly beneficial to me, because it gives me a lot of perspective. So for example, during lockdown, you know, if you're working at home on your own 10 hours a day in front of your computer and you're just interacting with the people that you interact with on your team, your perspective about what's happening is very small. And if you're struggling, it feels like it's only you that's struggling. But being a therapist, I speak to, you know, anything between 20 and 500 people a week, depending on what groups or talks I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I get to hear about what everyone is going through and how all these people are experiencing something slightly different.
Yeah.
And that gives me, that kind of holds me in good stead, because I can have a lot of perspective on a situation, because I understand that everyone is experiencing something. But it might be different to me, but they're experiencing some kind of level of difficulty or gratitude, or there's something going on. But yeah, I think that's where therapists flourish, because we have a fundamental understanding that everyone is slightly different, and it's about taking the effort to understand, listening to understand rather than listening to fix, which brings us back around to that idea that, you know, therapy isn't going to fix you, the stuff isn't going to fix you, but it's going to help you understand, and knowledge is power. And
and you have to understand yourself in order to do all that as well, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
If you're a rescuer, you're going to want to fix people, and
that's a whole other podcast.
That is, isn't it? But I mean, look, one of the things I noticed when I read your, I looked at your website and your 5-week program, and some of one of the things that stood out for me, because it's personally relevant, is the importance of social connection. Because I've been working at home a lot, and I need to be around, see other people. Yeah. So can you just elaborate on that? Because we've all experienced isolation, globally. But, you know, the importance for me of being with other people is fundamental. Would you say why that is, if that's true for other people, and why is it the case, do you think?
I think it's fundamental because, to use the metaphor, so we learn a lot about ourselves by being with other people. And if you were in a gym class and you weren't quite sure what was happening, or you were doing an exercise and you weren't sure if you were doing it right, you'd look at someone else to see how they were doing it, or at the instructor, or in the mirror. So you're getting reflection, literally, if it was a physical workout. And for our emotional well-being, we still need that reflection and that mirroring from other people to make sure that we understand and we're in touch with all the different parts of us. You know, often I don't know really how I'm feeling until I'm interacting with someone, or I've got on the tube, or, you know, something's happened to help me, to reflect back to me something that's going on inside of me. So social events are vital to our survival, because otherwise we end up in quite an insular, self-interested place where we don't let much feedback in and we don't learn about ourselves. We're also built for, you know, we are social, I know it's a cliche, but we are social animals, and we're built for it, we have an appetite for it. Yeah. Loneliness is something that is probably one of the most painful human experiences, because we just don't know when it's going to end. And the trouble with not socializing and becoming lonely at the extreme end of that is that then it becomes too risky to socialize again, because we're so worried about someone rejecting us or not being available or not being able to give us that mirroring that we're seeking and that care that we're seeking. So it sort of turns in on itself and can get worse and worse and worse over time. So in the program, I talk about 2 social events a week, and that can be modified to whether you're introverted, extroverted, or abnerverted, which is the one that's, you have to read the book, but it sits somewhere in between introvert and extrovert, and making that work for you, whether that's with 1 person or 6 people, whether it's for an hour or 3 hours, you know, understanding your social arousal levels well enough that you know exactly what you need in terms of socialization. And during lockdown, that was the most difficult one for me to try and modify for people, because you know, I've always been a bit old school. I always refused to do online therapy. I want people in the room so I can see their bodies and I can see what's happening and I can see all the sort of micro expressions. And during lockdown, I really had to adjust how I was working and how I was thinking to get what socially what I needed from seeing people online, for example, but also with my clients, and getting that feedback from seeing them on Zoom or not having them in the room with me. So yeah, it was sort of the most challenging one to talk about during the pandemic. And I would still say to everyone, you know, still be safe, follow the rules. Don't take, I've got to socialize twice a week, to mean that you can break all the rules. You have to do it safely. But yeah, it was tricky. It was tricky. Yeah. And I think that's just
really, I mean, it's
testament to how difficult it was.
Yeah. I mean, there were studies about how we're different on Zoom and we interpret things differently. People move, it's two dimensional and everything. And then, on top of that, you know, the only good thing, I guess, was that everybody was in the same boat, which might have made it easier. You know, everybody was lonely, everybody was struggling. But at the same time, some people would have come out of that or are still in it and had a real crisis, a breakdown, a meltdown, whatever you want to call it, and actually, you know, have been labelled with some very difficult mental health difficulty. So someone who's in that position, say somebody who's like might be suicidal or hearing voices or in that peak of anorexia or something like that, would it be right for them, or do they need, you know, do you have to do a bit of crisis management first, then come to your book? I'm trying to imagine if you're further down the line in trouble, you know, where.
Yeah, the book is a great for anyone who's sort of in this thick of it. So whether you know, psychosis, schizophrenia, anorexia, eating disorders, drug addiction, or manic, we call it bipolar. They've changed their names over time because of whatever. Anyway, I would say the book is a sort of, it's one of the stops you'll need in your recovery. Say, for example, you couldn't get the help that you needed or wanted, then the book would be a great way to structure your week ahead of you to kind of keep you safe if you can, if you feel up to that. Likewise, if you have had a bit of treatments, then it's a great way to kind of maintain some of the resources and the skills that you would have learned through your therapy or through your treatment. But I would say, yeah, if you're a little bit further into whatever's going on, you may well need to have a therapist or a mental health professional alongside you. In fact, in the first chapter, I talk about therapy. I open it up as I call it a therapeutic space, because there's lots of ways of getting therapy that don't mean you have to sit in front of a stranger and bare your soul. But yeah, if you have something that's a specific issue that you are working with, then I'd say you need to be working with a therapist to help you just handle whatever it is that comes up.
I guess it's like if you had a heart attack, you'd have that, fix the heart first, then get on the walking machine, then go to the personal trainer.
Yeah. You know, exactly. You've got to work with what's,
do a 10-mile run.
Yeah, work with what's hurting you most. And all the way through, I say, do what you can. I always say, like, I really kindly support people taking rests, taking breaks. I think they're important in terms of progress and productivity. Yeah. And only you really know what's the right thing and the right time for you to do those things. I prescribe it as like a 5-week plan, because
I was going to ask you about your 5 weeks.
It takes 4 weeks to form a habit. 5 weeks is sort of a good add-on. You can choose which bits you liked and which bits you don't, and there will be difference. If you were to do all the workouts for 5 weeks as I lay them out in the book, you will definitely see a difference.
Yeah,
not all the difference will be associated with what you've done your mental health workout, because what you'll find is the other things you start doing around that, because of the relationship that you develop with yourself, will benefit you as well. So I'm not, you know, completely delusioned that this, you know, it's not going to change your life.
Yeah.
But it is going to make a difference. And I say do it for 5 weeks, because then you can sort of make a choice as to what works for you and what doesn't. But also, to be quite honest, most people probably do it in a much more stop-start way.
Yeah.
And if I'm really brutal, that 5 weeks took me 10 years to come up with, if I really think about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are things that I have done and worked on and understood on a more deeply over the years, but it's taken a decade. So if you don't get it done in 5 weeks, chill. Don't worry about it. Do what you can. All the way through, I'm saying, don't worry if you fall off the wagon, you know, just come back to this point, et cetera, et cetera. So,
there is a circle, isn't there, in a psychology, I think, where you keep going back, and the further in you get further closer to the center, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like an onion.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I've been a personal trainer. It's very, very similar. Like, you know, 6 weeks was my sort of block for people who I train with. And they'd be all guns blazing, raring to go at the beginning, and then it would get a bit boring. And then the results don't necessarily, you know, people would come thinking that their whole life was going to be transformed in the 6 weeks. Well, it isn't, but it's gradually improved. Little tiny incremental changes do make a difference, but you don't always see them. And I think that's something that's important for people to understand when they take a book like yours on. It will improve their life, but don't expect to suddenly, you know, every problem to be solved.
Yeah.
Those small steps matter, don't they?
Yeah, they do, absolutely. But having said that, for some people, sometimes there's just one thing that clicks.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything is better. I've literally experienced that with clients. Over the years, I've had not many, maybe a handful of clients who have come in who, you know, feel like they're suicidal. They're only staying alive for their kid, because they can't leave their job or whatever. And then there's one thing that we cover and we tweak and we, you know, change the script or flip the perspective. And they're like, oh my God, that's what I needed. I needed permission to change that way of thinking, and everything just changes for them. So yeah, for some people, there will be something in there, little gems in there that fix a lot.
So let's go with that. Let's go with the clicks. I like because you're right, there are, it's like miracles happen. People and things happen for people. Some people, it is literally a momentary, you know, they see the light, whatever that light, however it's come to them. So it's always worth thinking you might be that person who sees the light and has the click, and it all, things change very dramatically for you, or they just improve. So, I mean, I love the analogy. I love the book. I think it's going to really catch on with people. So if you've got the book, you've got the website. Is there, people can find you on Instagram. Is there anywhere else that you are that would be?
I like Instagram. I'm at Your Mental Health Workout, and the website is yourmentalhealthworkout.com. I have a Twitter, but I'm not very good at it, so I just stick with Instagram, to be quite honest.
Yeah, Twitter's mostly people just having a go at each other, so journalists shouting at each other, that's what it is. So brilliant. So you can be, and your book is available through the website and in shops, and
Amazon bookshops. Amazon. Because of the pandemic, lots of the bookshops have had sort of backlog of books that they've got to sell before they order in loads of new books. So online's probably the best availability. But yeah, it should be in Waterstones, Foyles,
all the usual retail
Smith. Books. Yeah.
Listen, thanks so much. Really enjoyed talking to you, and look forward to hearing what comes next as well.
Amazing. Thank you, Fiona.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.